Prescriptions for Health with Dr. Len and Vicky Saputo. Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, November 21st, 2011. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicky Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Every Monday live from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time and from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are archived on DrSaputo.com and on PRN.FM.
And you're going to hear Vicky's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 22 the hours. And we got another great show for you today. Starting out with, got a delicious stinky herb that protects the heart. I wonder what that is.
And how too much iron can accelerate the aging process.
And colonoscopy screening is questioned finally by the National Cancer Institute. It's about time.
And we have even more news today on probiotics. Can they protect us from radiation damage? And how do we choose a probiotic? Are they all the same?
And shockingly, the American majority wants to repeal our Health Care Reform Act. There's so much to this story that's just shocking, and we'll review that.
And plus, if you want to join in our conversation and have questions about our topics or your health, give us a call at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. So I guess you can guess what this wonderful herb is that tastes good but gives you bad breath, and it's called a stinky rose. That's it. It's garlic. You don't have to worry about the garlic breath if you eat it with parsley. Well, sort of.
Or you don't have to worry about it if you feed it to your spouse, too.
That's true.
Because then you can't smell it so much.
Well, it's not new that garlic is healthy, but it's just been found that besides the healthy component of garlic called allicin that decreases blood pressure, there's another component that can actually protect the heart. So tell us about this dialyl trisulfide.
Right. Long name for a simple thing that says it makes smelly gas, which is no surprise.
Sulfur.
It's the sulfate. It's like hydrogen sulfide. You know that smell of eggs when they're rotten? That's it. And if you get too much of it, it's not a good idea. It's not healthy for you. But if you get just the right amount, it does a lot to protect your heart. If you've had a heart attack, or if you're in heart surgery, or you're in congestive heart failure, because it regulates blood flow, and it makes the arteries, the big ones and the little ones, dilate, and it does it just the right amount.
And that's really good, especially if it's the coronary arteries.
Boy, I'll say.
In the heart.
So maybe we should be consuming more garlic, okay, because that's where you get a lot of this stuff. And, of course, things like eggs, things that have the amino acid cysteine, methionine and taurine are loaded with it. And then there are certain kinds of things like fruits, the blueberries and cherries and grapes that have a lot of it. That was a surprise to me. And eggs, garlic, a lot of vegetables, particularly the cruciferous vegetables, a good thing to eat on a regular basis if you're going to prepare for your heart attack.
Well, cruciferous vegetables are things like kale and broccoli and Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, that family.
Mm-hmm.
Cabbage.
Right. So how does this work? Well, basically, studies were done on mice, and what they did is they clamp off one of the coronary arteries. And when you clamp that off for about 45 minutes, they're in trouble because they're having a heart attack. And what they found is that if they gave low-dose hydrogen sulfide to them right into the heart, that it reduced the damage from the heart attack by over 60%. So you're looking at something that's not a small factor. And, of course, it works in concert with nitric oxide, which is another substance we've been using for a lot of years in the form of nitroglycerin for people who have angina, that dilates up those coronary arteries as well. But the way that the dialyl trisulfide works and the hydrogen sulfide is it slows down the rate at which the mitochondria produce free radicals. And that may sound weird to you that the energy-producing part of our cells makes free radicals, but it does. And the reason it does is because it's a byproduct of making energy. And so as we make more energy through exercise, we make a lot more free radicals, and you're probably going, wait a minute, now, why is that good? Aren't we trying to get rid of free radicals?
Yeah, with antioxidants.
Yeah, well, the body's no dummy, and yes, it makes more free radicals, but it also makes a lot more in the way of antioxidant protection. So it makes more SOD, and it makes more other antioxidants that are cellular antioxidants.
So what's SOD? It's
got a long name to it. I've forgotten what it's. It's an abbreviation. Well, it's an antioxidant. It's an endogenous, meaning made in the body antioxidant. It's superoxide dismutase. That's what it is.
Oh, yeah.
You're testing me. and we make a lot more of that as we get in physical shape. Now, if we wind up taking a lot of antioxidants, which is a tendency on the part of people who are trying to be healthy, what are you really doing? You're building up your antioxidant levels, indeed, but at the expense of what? Turning off your endogenous or body's production of its own antioxidants.
Because it's dependent on it, huh?
Well, you need a certain amount. And when the body has a certain amount, because you're taking it in the form of pills, you know, the vitamin C and E and CoQ10 and all those things, well, that's nice, except it turns off the body's system of making its own stuff.
Because the body thinks it doesn't need to.
Exactly. And so when that happens, and you're exercising and you're not taking your antioxidants that day, what do you think is going to happen? You're going to be flooded with free radicals and not have the same protection. So there's much more value in exercising and staying in shape than there is to adding a lot of antioxidants to our system. So I'm a fan of exercise, stress reduction, healthy diet. Take in those natural antioxidants that are in food. Get plenty of rest so your body can repair itself. Go on ahead and exercise on a regular basis. And the more that you exercise, the more free radicals you make, the more your body will respond to making its own antioxidants.
And eat some garlic.
And eat some garlic. Exactly. Which is pretty tasty anyway. I think it's, you know, it's one of those things in life, being Italian, that I really look forward to. And we, you know, you can cook it in lots of ways. The cooked garlic is just fine. It doesn't have to be just fresh.
It used to be that people thought that it had to be raw for the allicin.
Well, you get more allicin when it's raw. That's true. And you also, by the way, need to crush it and let it sit for about 10 minutes, or else the allicin doesn't have time to form. So a lot of people don't know that. So what we do is we peel it, crush it, put in a little bit of olive oil, maybe put a little salt and pepper, parsley, so that doesn't make us stink so much. And
we keep it for a couple of days and use it to season a lot of our food.
Right, and you can bake it too. If you bake it, it's a wonderful spread, and you're still getting all that sulfur. Okay, the sulfur that's in the hydrogen sulfide, and in the important amino acids of thiamine, cysteine, and taurine, to give you what you need.
Now, I don't know. This is kind of an off the wall question, but how does this correlate with the sulfur that's in wine? Because they give that a bad rap.
That's a sulfite, and it's another kind. A preservative. And it's mostly in wines that are shipped from Europe to the United States, because with all the shaking going on in ships, the hydrogen sulfide protects, I guess, the flavor in the wine. That's different. And sulfide and sulfur are different, but they're related. And to a certain extent, sulfide's just fine. But people tend to get allergic to it. Some people do. And so it's one more thing that you add to what Mother Nature does that probably isn't the greatest thing to do. We think we're so smart by outfoxing Mother Nature. Oh, we can stop this by using that drug or that supplement. And it just often doesn't work that way.
Well, there's so much publicity nowadays about anti-aging. You know, everybody's trying to fight anti-aging. Or to fight aging with anti-aging, and a lot of it has to do with antioxidants.
Well, it's related to it for sure.
But another one has to do with iron.
Well, it does, but let's go back to your original story here. It has to do with the aging process and anti-aging medicine. What's the most powerful anti-aging strategy that we can use?
Getting enough sleep, exercising, eating a healthy diet, and reducing our stress.
Well, you got it. Exercise is the biggest thing. It makes more growth hormone, more testosterone, more DHEA, all those good things that we need just through hard exercise.
Of course, there are some people that can't exercise.
Well, you can always do some exercise. Even a quadriplegic can do some exercise with your mind. And the studies that have been done on that are kind of interesting. You can take athletes and have them do imagery of doing bicep exercises, okay, just doing lifts with their arms. And if they do that for 6 weeks and they compare them to people that are similar to who the treatment group is, they find that muscle strength increases by 15%.
So quadriplegics that are doing these exercises in their minds, mm-hmm. or people that are just doing a few of these
it's a mental exercise,
might be better off than some of the couch potatoes that are capable of doing it but that aren't doing
it. Well, maybe. I think that the couch potatoes are living shorter lives that have poorer quality of life, and they don't have enough antioxidants, and they're the ones that should be buying up the supply of antioxidants and other kinds of good nutrients that the body needs, because they generally don't eat a good diet either.
Of course, we don't want to be encouraging the couch potatoes to continue doing that and just visualizing that they're
exercising. Well, you know, just if a couch potato just does 1 hour of exercise a week, they will live longer and have fewer health problems than people that don't. And, of course, the people that do the best, the ones that do the hardest exercise, the ones that are really going after it and do what I call interval training. And what that means is when you're doing your exercise, say you're just running around a track, that make it simple. Instead of just jogging around the track, what I would suggest you do is jog and then run as fast as you can for 10 or 15 seconds. So you're just 100% going out. And in 10 or 15 seconds, that'll probably make you tired.
But you better ask your doctor first if it's okay for you to do that.
Well, that's for sure. I mean, if you're 80 years old and you got a heart problem, you're congestive heart failure, you may want to do a limited version of that, but you still want to do it. Because even people with congestive heart failure do better with exercise. Everybody does better with exercise. And the more you do, the more the body responds to it. That's why I love the idea of interval training.
Well, isn't there also a thing with this interval training that's a handy thing to do if you know how to do it, about taking your pulse and seeing how long it takes your pulse to get back down to normal?
Aren't you smart?
Like if you're really serious about it.
Well, that's right. I mean, I remember testing a guy who was on Medicare. Okay, this was a tennis player who since has died at the age of 88. It was Tom Brown, one of my heroes, Wimbledon finalist, and won the doubles and mixed there. This guy was in such good shape at age 65 that when I tried to do a modified stress test, I had him run up and down the stairs and come back, and I put the blood pressure cuff on him, or I'd take his pulse. And by the time I had that all set up, his pulse would be down to 60 again. And he said, well, I was really going, but he was in such good shape that the recovery didn't take long. And people who are in great shape, that's what it's like. So you may get your heart rate up as fast as you can. If you're younger, it might be 180. And if you're older, it may be something more like 130.
So how long should it take for it to go back down to normal?
The faster it goes back down to normal, the better your body is conditioned. And the better you're going to do.
So there's no certain amount of time.
No, but if it takes 10 minutes, you know you're not in very good shape. If it takes 30 seconds, or you don't even have time to measure it because the guy comes down so fast, he's in great shape. And, of course, that was Tom Brown's story.
Oh.
So we should all try to do the best we can, especially as we age. Because as we age and we're older, it's much more difficult to get in shape. And once you get out of shape, you stay out of shape for a longer time. So from age 25 to 30, or 20 to 30, say, you get back in shape in a few weeks. And you're doing fine. By the time you're 65 or 70, it's going to take you 3 to 6 months to get back in shape. And then when you stop, you'll get out of shape faster. So
yeah, it doesn't take long. If you don't use it, you lose it.
Yes, and then you're at more risk for developing all kinds of diseases that are related to not being as fit as you can. Things like hypertension and diabetes and heart attacks and strokes and all the things that go with that. So exercise is your friend, just like garlic is your friend. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Stavuta here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. So if you have a question about your health, give us a call.
We're always hearing that we need iron or we may be anemic, and the truth is that only menstruating women, pregnant women, and babies, and of course those that are bleeding, may need iron supplements. So tell us why iron can be a serious problem.
Well, let's look first at the frequency of people who have too much iron. that's probably 10 or 15% of the population. And some new research that's being done shows it may be closer to 40%, but that's not published yet. So we're looking at a huge number of people in the population who have too much iron. And when you have too much iron,
it's bad.
It causes free radicals to develop. When iron is in the body in high concentrations, it reacts with the body to produce a lot of hydroxyl radicals and other radicals that are going to make you age quickly. So you want to measure your iron levels. There are four parameters that you can do. We don't need to go into the details of that. But when you go to your doctor, you should have a screen to see if you have too much iron. Because if you fall into that 10 or 15% that has too much iron, you're going to be aging quickly.
Well, there are some people that have genetic defects, and they have something called hemochromatosis.
These are the people I'm actually talking about. These are the people I'm talking about, Vicki. And there's two forms of it. One is homozygous, meaning they have two genes that are both positive for hemochromatosis, and they're heterozygous, meaning there's only one gene. And it's the people who have one gene that's possible, that's positive, that account for the 10 to 15% of people that I'm talking about. So this thing you're calling hemochromatosis is very common. And if you have the homozygous, which is about 1 in 300 or 250 or 300 people, you're going to have problems with cirrhosis, diabetes, arthritis, erectile dysfunction, heart attack, strokes, cancer, pituitary problems, and skin discoloration. No small thing.
Well, something that I think is an aside that people should be aware of is using iron skillets.
Real good point.
Because you get iron out of iron skillets, and a lot of people use them that don't need the iron. For example, men don't need all this extra iron, you know,
right.
Like I said, unless they're bleeding have hemochromatosis.
Right,
or something.
And women after the menopause.
The opposite.
Women after the menopause don't need it either because they're not menstruating anymore.
Exactly.
So that's when we see the largest rise in the aging process that's sped up because of that.
Everybody thinks, well, it's just a nice piece of cookware, and they think it's better than Teflon because Teflon is very, very tough to...
Right, and like you said earlier, children,
toxic.
You know, babies, infants, neonates, definitely need to have enough iron because if they don't, they have a problem with mental retardation. So it's tricky. You can have too much or too little and you're in trouble. So what's the answer? Measure it. Find out where you are. Particularly if you're going to have a baby. You want to know exactly where you are with iron.
Because the baby's using up your iron.
Yes. And if you've got too much of it, that's going to be a problem for the baby as well. So you want to measure it, know where you are. And if you're like most women, you're going to need to take iron supplements. Because, you know, 85% of you are iron deficient probably compared to the 10 or 15% that have relatively more. The other interesting thing about iron is it's carcinogenic, and it also tends to make infections spread faster. And that's because cancer cells love to sequester iron, and so do cells that are infected by bacteria. So if you've got cancer or you've got an infection, the last thing you want to do is be taking doses of iron to supplement because you'd be making things worse. And, of course, there's a whole thing that has to do with treating cancer. People who have cells that have sequestered iron using a herb called wormwood, or also known as artemisinin.
We have a lot about that also on drsaputo.com.
That's where I'm going to refer you to get the information because there's a whole story on that that is very exciting that talks about how the iron and how artemisinin work together. So it'll give you a story that's in detail. So the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Saput here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We have a couple of calls waiting. We'll get to them when we come back after Vicki's first 2020 tip.
To maintain a healthy level of sanity, I have some ideas for you. And of course, if you don't want to actually do them, you can just imagine doing them and laugh because laughter is the best medicine. So here's one. This is to reduce your stress. At lunchtime, sit in your parked car with sunglasses on and point a hairdryer at passing cars and see if they slow down. Here's another idea. Page yourself over the intercom at work and don't disguise your voice. Every time somebody asks you to do something, ask if they want fries with that. Put decaf in the coffee maker for 3 weeks. Once everyone has gotten over their caffeine addictions, switch to espresso.
Oh, jeez.
In the memo field of your checks, write, for marijuana. Skip down the hall rather than walk and see how many looks you get. Order a diet water whenever you go out to eat with a serious face. And specify that your drive-thru order is to go. Try singing along at the opera. And 5 days in advance, tell your friends you can't attend their party because you have a headache. I don't know if that's such a great idea. My brother did that once when my dad wanted him to do some work for him. He says, oh, I can't work because I'm going to be sick. And my dad never got over it. I don't think he ever, yeah, he didn't think it was funny. When the money comes out the ATM, scream, I won, I won. When leaving the zoo, start running toward the parking lot yelling, run for your lives, they're loose. Tell your children over dinner, well, due to the economy, we're going to have to let one of you go. I don't know, that one might not be such a funny one.
Right.
But the final way to keep a healthy level of sanity, if you're a guy, is you pick up a box of condoms at the pharmacy and go to the counter and ask where the fitting room is.
Oh, jeez, Vicki. Well, there's a little levity for you. Well, thanks for that, Vicki. The lines are open. This is for Shifts for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuni with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We have a call from Tom in Illinois. Hi, Tom, you there?
Sure, Doctor. It's a pleasure hearing from you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. How are you today?
I'm pretty good. We've shared a couple of emails recently, and I'm dealing with prostate cancer. You had mentioned that in the emails that I had a Gleason score of 8, and you had some alternatives.
8? I thought it was a 6.
Or 6, I'm sorry, 6.
Big difference there.
Sure, yeah, yes, you're right. And that you had some alternative methods or of screening and or treatment. My urologist had suggested what is called a cyberknife, which unfortunately my insurance company on a pre-authorization has not approved. The alternative treatment would be the Calypso. Alternative form of exterior radiation.
Well, the cart's in front of the horse here, Tom, and I'll tell you why. The Gleason score is really important, and you had like 10 biopsies, and only one showed up, and one other was suspicious. And the Gleason score of 6 is, yes, you have a cancer, but the chances of that cancer killing you are probably at about 2 or 3%. Okay, so it's the kind of thing that you can watch and wait. You don't necessarily have to jump in and do anything. In fact, I'd recommend against that at this point, unless there's more that I don't know about. What I'd like to do is suggest that you assess the extent of the tumor. And you can do that in a couple of ways. It's pretty accurate. One is you can get an MRI with spectroscopy. And that can be done at a few medical centers. I know at University of California, San Francisco, they do that. And it's a how old are you, Tom?
I'm 58.
So your insurance would have to pay for this, and it's expensive. It's
$5,800.
Yeah, I know that. But he may have it at the University of Illinois or one of the universities there. So that would be one thing. Another approach is to do what's called a 3D, 4D sonogram or echo of the prostate. And I know you can get that in New York from a fellow named Dr.
Gonzalez?
Bard.
Huh? Wasn't it Dr. Gonzalez?
No, it was Dr. Bard. He's a radiologist in New York who you can Google. Robert Bard is his name. Actually, he's not a urologist. He's a radiologist there. And he does the test. That's about $800. And what these tests do is give you a nice picture of what the area that has been biopsied shows. I mean, is there a lump there, first of all? What's the size of the lump? What does the blood supply that goes to it look like? Has it extended to the capsule of the prostate, or has it gone beyond it? Lots of information that can give you an idea of whether or not you even need to do this because you may not need to do it if it doesn't show much. And then from time to time, you can repeat the test and see if anything's changing. And, of course, you can follow your PSA score as well at that time. And you may never need to do a surgery, Tom.
Right. Yeah.
So I think we got, that's why I said we got the horse, the cart in front of the horse.
Sure. I understand. Yeah, there's always that thing that you don't want this in your body. So let's
get rid of it. Yeah, I understand that.
You know,
well, we wind up doing too many surgeries because, you know, 95% of them are unnecessary. And there are complications from the surgeries at times, too. Things like incontinence and impotence and MRSA infections, you know, the methicillin-resistant staph that affects about 5% of people that go into the hospital.
You get
a complication like those, you're not going to be too happy, and you probably wonder if maybe you should have been a little bit more thoughtful about rushing into it. And unfortunately, our urologists, our surgeons, are looking to do surgery. That's what they do.
Right.
So they make their income.
Well, yeah, I had an alternative that my urologist was mentioning about proton therapy, which of course he indicated that some of these doctors who are advocating, the others are, have some vested interest in this. Now they have that machine that does the proton therapy, and of course, they're going to support.
Well, just like he does surgery, there's a conflict of interest there just as well. Right?
Exactly. Right. They do the transponder and all that other things to be able to do that. So it'll be interesting to see how things go. I've got to make a decision within the next week or so as to what direction I want to go. But
why is that, Tom? Why do you have to make a decision now? Why can't you wait?
Well, I could, you know, just based on some of the information you've had, and maybe I can contact Dr. Bartsch and see what his thoughts are as well.
I would have a conversation with him. Look him up on Google search and get his contact information, and I'm sure he'll be happy to talk to you. And he may suggest that this 3D, 4D sonogram that he does there is available in your area now, because I'm looking back 3-4 years ago since I talked to him, and so that could be the case.
I appreciate that very much, Doctor. I appreciate it, and good to talk to you. I appreciate all your help and support and everything you do.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks
good
for
luck,
calling.
Good luck, Tom.
Yeah, good luck.
Thank you, Vicki. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. The lines are open. The number is 888-874-4888. We have a call from Neil in North Carolina. Hi, Neil.
Hello, Dr. Saputo.
How are you?
I'm fine. To the best of my recollection, it is you who mentioned a few weeks ago about vitamin D3. Am I remembering the right show?
Could easily be. I talk about vitamin D3 all the time.
Okay. The reason I'm asking right now about it is at that time I was taking 5,000 IU and my blood level was somewhere around 70, and I think you mentioned that
that's perfect.
You like between 100 and 140.
Nope, that was somebody else saying that, because that's in the toxic range. I don't recommend that. Where you are is absolutely perfect. You want to be at about 70.
Maybe I better drop back to the 5,000 then. Okay.
Yeah, I would, because you were in the right place when you started. And that'll help protect against a lot of things, as you know. But for our listeners who don't know, I mean, it helps protect against cancer, particularly of the prostate, the colon, breast for women. It protects against diabetes and hypertension and heart attacks and strokes. It really does a lot of important things. And plus osteoporosis, which everybody
knows
about.
It even protects against skin cancer, and that's, you know, what everybody's afraid of getting it from the sun.
Right. So, Neil, you've done a good job at getting it to 70, and that's where I'd stay.
Okay. Well, then it was a different show, because that person on the other show recommended to get it up between 100 and 140.
Well, there are problems with keeping that sustained at that place, because it can cause calcifications in your kidneys, which can lead to hypertension and renal insufficiency. So I'd be a little careful about going higher than about 70. I think it's a good place, unless there's a special reason. So thanks for calling, Neil.
Thank you.
Okay, have a great day. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we'll be back taking your calls after a short station break. Keith, The number is 888-874-4888.
You know, finally, the Journal of the National Cancer Institute is coming out with some questions about colonoscopy screening, and they're questioning the value of routine colonoscopies. You know, it's sort of like, oh, happy birthday, you're 50, now go get a colonoscopy. But it sounds like they're finally figuring out that the risks rival the benefits of getting them.
Well, they really don't know. And what this group in this journal has come out saying is it's about time we take a careful look and find out, because we know that the benefits occur in about 1 in 200 people who have a colonoscopy as a routine screening. And for those people, that's an important thing because it may save their life. But 1 in 200 also, we're going to have a perforation, okay, from that.
Or bleeding.
Or GI bleeding that will lead to a transfusion that you'll be hospitalized for. So the question then becomes, well, is it really worth it if that's what the risks are? Keep in mind that if you're fit and you're exercising regularly, your risk isn't 1 in 200. It's more like 1 in 300 or 1 in 400.
And like you said earlier, getting enough vitamin D.
Such a good point, Vicki. Absolutely. Vitamin D will probably lower it again to another, so maybe instead of 1 in 200, it's 1 in 300 or 1 in 400. So when you combine the two together, you're looking at maybe 1 in 400 or 500 people who are fit and have adequate vitamin D levels that are going to have an important finding when they do a colonoscopy. In that setting, as a routine screening, meaning there's no reason to do a colonoscopy except that it's a screening test, people don't have any complaints, you're better off not doing it. And I haven't recommended this for my patients probably in years.
Well, you know, when we're talking about, you know, symptoms like GI bleeding or abdominal pain,
sure,
or vomiting and diarrhea.
Sure.
Sometimes they do these tests to rule out cancer. If somebody has another type of cancer,
sure,
they want to see if it's spread or not.
Sure. Or if they have ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease. I mean, a colonoscopy is a great test to do in that setting. For people who have symptoms or who have health issues, colonoscopy is a wonderful test because it'll you can see what's going on there, and you can take biopsies and you can remove little cancers or polyps or things that shouldn't be there.
So what's the difference between the results of that and doing like just stools for occult blood or a sigmoidoscopy?
Okay. Well, the stools for occult blood are notoriously inaccurate, meaning there are a lot of false positives. People on aspirin, for example, are going to have a false positive.
Or maybe
test.
If you had hemorrhoids, too. Huh?
Oh, sure. There's local bleeding there from a fissure or hemorrhoids. The number of people that you're going to actually save from a cancer is substantial, but there are so many false positives that lead to additional testing that it makes you wonder. The sigmoidoscopy, on the other hand, is a good test to do.
It doesn't go as far up.
It's a much, much easier thing to do. You don't perforate colons and you don't have so much problem with bleeding. But what you do is just look at the side of the colon, which is the left side, that has most of the cancers anyway. And when you talk about...
Why do people mostly have it on the left side?
It's just the way it is. Well, that's just what we found. That's where they seem to grow. I don't think anybody knows why.
Mm-hmm.
And the colonoscopy tends to miss a lot of the cancers that are on the right side because they're hard to see. They tend to be flat. So it's not like it's a fail-safe procedure, and it's not that there aren't complications, and it's certainly not fun. Plus, you're going to wind up with some kind of anesthesia, which has its problems, too. So,
and it's uncomfortable, and the preparation sucks.
Yeah, right.
Sucks.
I mean, if you don't need to do the test, don't. But it's sort of like a rite of passage in the medical profession. And I have to say that the American College of Gastroenterology is avidly supporting it, which doesn't surprise you. But it probably won't surprise you that the radiologists are recommending the virtual colonoscopy, okay, which is a radiological procedure. And I wonder how much of this is a turf war that has to do with income. You know, it makes
because
you really wonder.
The virtual colonoscopy is a lot more expensive.
Well, I don't think it's more expensive, is it?
Oh, I thought it was.
If you go in the hospital and you have a colonoscopy and you're having an anesthetic with it, you're talking about pretty big bucks, a couple thousand bucks probably.
That's true. Huh?
So a virtual colonoscopy is probably under $1,000.
But you're getting a lot of radiation.
That's the problem. You're right. And so
that could cause the cancer you're trying to rule out.
Well, yeah, it could. The odds of it are very small. And so for that reason, I don't know that that alone would stop me from wanting to do
it. But
if
it was positive, then they'd have to do a colonoscopy anyway.
That's
so if you're going to do it, you might as well just do it in the first place.
Now you've hit the nail on the head. That's right.
You know, I came across just a couple little comments that from nurses that they had heard patients saying while they were getting colonoscopies. I just wanted to share a couple of them. One of them says, "Hey, now I know how a Muppet feels."
Oh, jeez.
And the other one says, "Hey, doc, let me know if you find my dignity."
Oh, jeez.
"And you used to be an executive in Enron, didn't you?" to the doctor. "And then also, could you write a note for my wife saying that my head is not up there?"
Oh, jeez, Vicki, you're funny. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuti here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we'll come back taking your calls after Vicki's next 2020 tip.
Well, laughter's the best medicine, especially especially with the stress of frustration that comes with having a computer. I went through that one myself last night.
Yes, yeah, I know. You're still going through it.
So, for all of us who feel only the deepest love and affection for the way computers have enhanced our lives, at a recent computer expo at Comdex, Bill Gates reportedly compared the computer industry with the auto industry, and he stated this was a mistake. He said, "If GM had kept up with technology like the computer industry has, we would all be driving $25 cars that got 1,000 miles to the gallon." Well, in response to Bill's comments, General Motors issued a press release stating, "If GM had developed technology like Microsoft, we would be driving cars with the following. For no reason whatsoever, your car would crash twice a day. Every time they repainted the lines in the road, you would have to buy a new car.
That's right.
Occasionally, your car would die on the freeway for no reason. You'd have to pull to the side of the road, close all the windows, shut off the car, restart it, and reopen the windows before you could continue." Have you ever had that happen?
Yeah, that's funny.
No, I've had that happen. "And for some reason, you would simply accept this. Now, occasionally, executing a maneuver such as a left turn would cause your car to shut down and refuse to restart, in which case you'd have to reinstall the engine. Now, Macintosh would make a car that was powered by the sun, was reliable, five times as fast, twice as easy to drive, but would only run on 5% of the roads. Now, the airbag system would ask, 'Are you sure?' before deploying. Occasionally, for no reason whatsoever, your car would lock you out and refuse to let you in until you simultaneously lifted the car door handle, turned the key, and grabbed hold of the radio antenna."
Oh, jeez.
"Every time a new car was introduced, car buyers would have to learn how to drive it all over again because none of the controls would operate in the same manner as the old car."
That's so true. Just buy another software program and see how long it takes you to learn it.
"You'd have to press the start button to turn the engine off." Well, here are a couple of just add-ons. "When all else fails, you could call customer service in some foreign country and be instructed in some foreign language how to fix your car yourself."
Yeah, right.
"Or no one over the age of 65 could drive more than 1 mile before having to have a grandchild come and restart the car."
That's the truth.
You know, I'll bet a few people could add some more comparisons.
I'll bet they can, too.
So touche to Bill Gates, huh?
I'll say poor Bill. That's right. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. The number is 888-874-4888.
Well, there's a lot more news this week again. You know, it seems every week we're talking about probiotics.
It's amazing, you know, the shift that we've had in the last 20 years from the gastroenterologists who thought it was junk 20 years ago and now beginning to get the idea that it does a few good things.
Yeah, they're finally catching on. Well, you know, they're finally finding their way to mainstream medicine and protecting the gut now from radiation.
Boy, that's a surprise.
Yeah. Scientists in St. Louis have shown that probiotics before radiation therapy can protect the intestine from damage. And we don't want the intestinal lining to break down because that can lead to nasty diarrhea and sepsis and could actually kill you.
Yeah.
So maybe you want to define and talk about the importance of the bowel microflora, some of the benefits.
Well, see, the intestinal tract has 1,000 different species of microbes in it that live in a very complex ecosystem. And if you disturb that ecosystem, it breaks down and lots of things go wrong. In fact, you cannot be healthy. And we do so many things that interfere with that ecosystem, especially when we go to the doctor.
Well, most people think of it being with antibiotics, but there's a lot more things than antibiotics.
Yeah, well, that's a big one because, of course, that kills. The natural, it kills all the bugs.
The good with the bad.
Well, yeah, but it kills all the bugs that the antibiotic works on, which is the friendly microbes that we need that do so many services for us. And they leave a lot of open space there for other microbes to go to grow that are resistant to it. Things like Candida and C. difficile and Salmonella and cholera, all those kinds of things that can cause problems. So it's really important that we leave that microflora alone. And if we're going to disturb it with antibiotics or birth control pills or steroids or infections, we need to do something about restoring it. So a good probiotic, which has the friendly microbes in it, is important because what does a normal GI flora do for us? I mean, it's important in the metabolism of hormones and carcinogens and toxins. It makes vitamins for us. It takes inactive vitamin D and makes, vitamin K that we eat and turns it into vitamin K2, which is what we need. It helps make vitamin B5, B6, and biotin. It makes a chemical called butyrate, which is the most important metabolic fuel for the gut. So we have to have that, and that's where we get it for the most part. It also, they crowd out things like C. difficile, which causes a terrible infection that people in the hospital get so often, and Salmonella and other things like that. It stimulates the immune system to make antibodies. All these are the function of the normal microflora of the gut.
And other things besides antibiotics can cause this, like the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, like ibuprofen, Advil, Aleve, that family of drugs, mm-hmm. birth control pills, mm-hmm. steroids, mm-hmm. infections, diet, and of course, the antibiotics.
Yeah, so that's there's a lot to that. And then if you have abnormal microflora in there, it becomes even a bigger problem because some of the abnormal microflora, they can attack the enzymes that we need to have to digest our food. It can lead to maldigestion and malnutrition. They can consume our vitamin B12 and some essential amino acids. They can destroy essential fatty acids like the omega-3s and 6s. And a number of other things that just lead on and on to more problems.
Well, I think a common one is yeast infections. We hear about that a lot, Candida, and mm-hmm. and they used to advertise those vaginal suppositories on television a lot for women that would have yeast infections.
Exactly.
But I think that with people learning about probiotics, you know, might not have to get to that point.
Well, that's right. And now, what about the gut and radiation? That was a surprise to me. And what they did is they studied mice, and they gave them doses of radiation that should cause damage to the gut. And what they did was they gave them the probiotic before they did that. And to everybody's surprise, they didn't have all the signs and symptoms of what radiation does to the gut, like causing diarrhea or constipation or bloating or distension, all the things that go with irritable bowel syndrome. And so that's just interesting to know. The mechanism, they thought, was probably related to being anti-inflammatory, and it probably uses some of the same mechanisms as the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs do because it involves the COX-1 and COX-2 inhibitors.
One of the things, too, that's really bad is if it breaks down the lining of the intestine, it can cause leaky gut. And so then some of the microbes that are in your intestine can get out through that wall into the rest of your body and make you sick.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And so it's really important. So does this work in humans? I'm almost certain that it would have to. I mean, why wouldn't it? If it works in a mouse, it should work in a human because we have so many similarities in our physiology. And so there's really not much to use it because people are using probiotics anyway on a fairly regular basis, and it's not causing any problems.
Yeah, another thing I don't think we mentioned was that probiotics are also good for hay fever and asthma.
And there's a stretch, isn't it? Now, how does that work? I'll have to explain that to you because it's an interesting story. They published this actually out of University of California, San Francisco, about 5 or 10 years ago. And what they did is they know that people who have asthma and hay fever are inhaling pollens and things that the body shouldn't react to, but still does. And when you do inhale those substances, your lung clears them out about every 20 to 30 minutes.
So what do? You and swallow them.
It goes to the back of your throat, exactly, and you swallow it, and then it goes down into the gut. Now, in the gut, we have these cells that are the microbes that work as sentinels for the GI tract and its immune system. And they can recognize things like pollens and food products and things that are in the air that are non-toxic, that aren't a problem. And they send out little messengers to the immune system, little cytokines, that say, hey, this is just pollen. Don't worry about it. You don't have to make a whole bunch of antibodies. But if those guys aren't there, the message doesn't get to them. And sometimes they start making antibodies against these things that they shouldn't be. And that's how you develop things like hay fever and asthma. Very interesting mechanism.
Okay, now when somebody wants to go get some probiotics, there's a huge variety and lots of choices, and there's some on the shelves that have, I don't know, 900 billion and some of them that have however many other billions, but some of them are in the refrigerator, some of them aren't. I mean, how do you know which one to get?
Well, you really don't, and you have to look at the one that has the prettiest box or seems to appeal to you the most, but the data a lot of the time isn't there. And I have to say that there is a company that has done some work. They actually have published about, I'd say, 80 scientific papers that have looked at the effects that these probiotics have. And I'm not necessarily supporting this company, although I'll give them credit for doing the studies, because they unfortunately wrote the article that I'm reporting on. And so, of course, they're going to say that their product is the best. And that particular one is called VSL number 3.
And it's prescription, though, right?
It's a prescription, and it's reasonably expensive. But it's a medical food, which means that your insurance company will pay for it. So if your doctor feels a probiotic is a good thing for you, this should be one of the things that I would probably look towards to get, because there's at least some data on it. And is it better to have it refrigerated? Of course it's better. But a lot of companies will promote and say, well, you don't need to refrigerate this because it only loses 5% of its activity per month. Well, if you've got 7 or 8 or 10 billion bacteria in there that can each make colonies because they're alive, that's good. But if you've got somewhere between 150 and 900 billion, which VSL number 3 does, that's pretty good. And you might want to go with that. I think the future for probiotics is really interesting, because we're going to be finding that certain probiotics that have certain kinds of bacteria in them are going to be doing different jobs to protect us from different problems than other microbes might. That's going to take some time and some research to be done, and I can't wait to see what that's going to show, because I know that in a lot of settings, almost any probiotic that's got Acidophilus and Bifidobacter and certain kinds of strep and certain kinds of E. coli, they do wonders for people who have all kinds of problems, problems like irritable bowel syndrome, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, pouchitis, which most people don't know about except those people that have it. It's a real problem. It can be a really interesting way to go about making people feel better. And I might say that this VSL number 3 is approved by the FDA for ulcerative colitis, IBS, and ileal pouch. And
well,
pouchitis.
Eventually we'll probably have certain probiotics for different conditions.
That's right. That's right.
I also wanted to talk just for a second about before people are going to get radiation exposure, besides maybe taking some probiotics before they do that, especially include lactobacillus, is to take some vitamin C, like about 2 to 3 grams of that before you have an x-ray to protect you from some of the radiation damage.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's an important thing to keep in mind. Okay, so that's interesting to know. The lines are open here on Prescriptions for Health. The number is 888-874-4888.
So we were going to talk about some other things besides probiotics today. I have like a pile of stuff on probiotics.
Yeah, I know. Well, so much about them. It's so interesting.
So anyway, what do you think is going to happen with healthcare reform now that so many want to just repeal the whole thing? I mean, are they being sensible or are they just wanting to throw the baby out with the bathwater? I mean, the good with the bad. Do you think this is about not getting Obama reelected or really wanting to start over?
Well, I mean, look at the history over the last 3 years. 3 years ago, the doctors, the people, most politicians, President Obama, were talking about universal health care and what a good idea that was. Not the Republicans, but most everybody else. And we have managed to come full circle in 3 years. So we're talking about, even though the Affordable Care Act was passed, and doesn't really do that much in lots of areas, more Americans are starting now to think that it wasn't such a good idea. God knows why. My take on this is that the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry have so much money that they can brainwash us pretty easily, and we're pretty vulnerable to that. And so we've come full circle. And now we're looking at the negative aspects of what's unfolded and forgotten what our initial premise was, which was to give people affordable health care and that everybody would get it. I mean, every industrialized country in the world has it except this country. And we're so engrossed and so attached to the economics of this country that we've made medicine a business instead of a service. And so it's about money now. I mean, how can you spend twice as much as most every other industrialized country and still be ranked 37th in the world in overall quality of care? I mean, that's quite an achievement to do because you can't just throw healthcare dollars or dollars at healthcare.
I mean, that proves right there that it's not about money.
Well, I think it proves that healthcare isn't about money, but it proves that the business of healthcare is about money. And so what we're looking at is Americans really losing their way. And to see a survey that comes back that say they want to repeal the healthcare act is, to me, just stunning because everybody deserves healthcare. And we should be doing everything that we can to support getting health care to everybody. And at least we've got 30 more million Americans that are eventually going to be covered of the 50 million that are uninsured.
Unless they repeal it.
Well, I mean, it may get repealed. Who knows what's going to happen? We're seeing the split of the classes become so big that people are on the streets with this Occupy Wall Street, which is a wonderful thing, I think, because what we're doing is we're having a revolution.
Except for nobody's paying attention to it. They're just paying attention to what's going on between the police and the protesters.
Well, that's
rather than what they're marching or sitting for.
Well, I think some of that's true, but I think that the people are getting the message that we have a disparity in wealth that's unrealistic. It's not right, and that something needs to be done about it. And I support that. I think that's great. But revolution after revolution after revolution doesn't usually change how we operate. You have to combine revolution with evolution. And until we change as individuals and become more willing to walk our talk and to set the example and be the change you want to see, that there won't be any evolution. And that's what we need to have if we want to evolve to the next higher level of consciousness. And we, the people, can do that. And a lot of people think that just because they're only one person, that it doesn't count. But I say that's the only thing that counts, is the one person walking their talk, to be followed by a second person, and a third, and a 50th, and a 100th, and a 1,000th, and then millions, because that's how it works.
So quickly, can you just tell me about this open market insurance as opposed to active purchasers? Because that's been some talk about the insurance companies.
Well, the insurance companies want to make money. They don't want to be controlled in any way. And, of course, what happens is that according to the Affordable Care Act, we're going to have these insurance companies having to report to the state, and the state is going to evaluate them and tell you which ones give you what and how much it's going to cost them to make recommendations. And that's what we should be, that's what we should have. But it's only one more step in the middle of something that is not really the best way to go. I think what we need to do is take a hard look at what healthcare is about and what kind of healthcare reform we want. And we should be moving from a sick care system to a wellness system.
And you talk about some of this in your book, A Return to Healing.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, that brings us to the close of our show. And I'd like to remind you that we'll be back to back live to talk about what's new in the news and health and take your health questions every Monday afternoon on Progressive Radio Network and also drsaputo.com. And Prescriptions for Health will also be archived at drsaputo.com as well as prn.fm.
And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe, so if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
See you next week.